Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Sakina Rahim will be telling us a little bit about her experiences with Smile Canada. So, can you tell me a little bit about your experiences with Smile Canada?
So, I've actually been a part of this organization since, as long as I can remember, since I was a kid. I've seen it grow and grow and grow. Basically, my position, before I was just a volunteer for Smile. My position at Smile now is as their admin's assistant. So basically, in other words, what that means is I provide assistance to the whole team, basically. I provide support to specifically the programs coordinator. I work alongside of our programs coordinator with in terms of coordinating programs, setting up events, coming up with ideas for events, outreach, contacting other organizations, influencers, people, and connecting and trying to collaborate with them. In terms of families specifically, I do not connect with families on a one-on-one basis. However, I do, when there is a family who needs support or help, I always ensure that the information is provided to our service navigations team. That way, they can directly help them themselves.
So, in recent memory, how have you seen Smile supporting newcomers to Canada with a family member who has a disability?
So, Smile has helped newcomers in forms of assisting families find various resources that might be beneficial to them. So, we have a couple of programs. The first one, specifically, is our scholarship program, which provides financial aid to families who are in need of therapy, respite services, and adaptive equipment. We also have funding applications outside of Smile. For example, we have Esther Seals, the incontinence supply application. We have special services at home. We have assistance for children with severe disabilities program, and then there is the Jennifer Ashley Children's Charity. So we also conduct research outside of the organization on behalf of the families. We inform families registered with Smile about future events that we hold through our WhatsApp announcement groups. We have various WhatsApp announcement groups. We've actually expanded. Before it was specifically in the GTA, we've now expanded all across Canada. We inform families about the support groups and offer help to sign them up through WhatsApp. We also have a mother support group, a sibling support group, a father support group, virtual events. We have live sessions with other collaborators as well. Some other things we do is we connect parents and caregivers outside of our WhatsApp groups. We have a registered hospital support program as well.
So, how do you go about reaching out to the families specifically to let them know that your services are available?
So there are a couple ways that we do this. One of the first ones and one of the main ones that we use is through intake forms on Google Forms. So these intake forms are submitted to the service navigators on our team via through email or our Smile website. And if you actually go on our Smile website, you'll see that the intake form is right there, ready to be filled out. We sometimes register families We sometimes register families through booths. Obviously, because of the pandemic, it hasn't been the same for a couple of years now. But previously, in the past years, we've actually set up booths at different events, different local mosques, and just local spaces where we set up a booth and just tell them a little bit about Smile. And then we also have various organizations and professionals, for example, Holland Bloorview, Sick Kids, social workers, occupational therapists, that reach out to us, letting us know of a client that they have that could benefit from our services.
So, in your time with Smile, is there any success moment that you've experienced that stands out for you?
I'd say one of our biggest successes is just the increase in the number of families that we have been able to support over the years. So we've had a significant increase in financial scholarships as well. The amount of therapy sessions that we've been able to help covering the cost of equipment, assistive technology with those scholarships have been very beneficial as well. Smile families connecting with one another, just making bonds, making connections, getting to know each other, feeling like they have someone with them where they're not alone in this situation is just a great success in itself. And then lastly, I think families feeling as if they have finally been heard and their stories and experiences have been taken into consideration, because this is something that not a lot of people talk about and a lot of families are struggling with. And just being able to help those people just overcome that and through it is a success in its own.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for the future of this work and the need to support these families as they transition to life here in Canada, what would you say?
I would say, if you know anyone who might benefit from our organization, please, please, please let us know or let them know about our organization. We are here to help those people who need it the most. And if you could donate, if you could share our story, our goal, that would be really, really helpful.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for Smile?
So, we actually have two grants. So, we have the United Way and Vital Signs. These are not finalized grants, however. We also have a collaboration with Sakina Homes, where we have where we would like to have a transitional home for single moms with children with disabilities, but that is also not finalized. We have community conversations with connecting with other collaborators, community leaders, organizations, and we also have upcoming, of course, is Ramadan. So we have a whole bunch of Ramadan events planned out for families and just the general public to attend. Obviously, most are going to be virtual, but our Eid event, which is one of our biggest events coming up, is one that we are doing in person, hopefully, if the pandemic and all the craziness persists. But yeah, other than that, that's pretty much it.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
No problem.
In this segment of our show, Erwin Ellman will be telling us a little bit about his disabilities work. So, Can you tell me a little bit about your disabilities work?
Okay. So, my name is Erwin Ellman. I was a child advocate for 12 years, from 2008 till 2019. And my job was to elevate the voices of children and youth who were not usually heard and who were at the edges of being afforded their rights. I was an officer of the ledge, had a piece of legislation that told me how I was to do my work. And one of the groups that I was identified in the legislation were people, young people, children who were living with what the legislation called special needs, which is Ontario's way of describing people with disabilities. So we would work individually with people with disabilities, young people, children with disabilities, to make sure their voices were heard. And then we work collectively. So we bring young people with disabilities together and support them to figure out what they wanted to say and make sure the people who were making decisions in their lives heard them.
So in that sense, why is it you think that young people with disabilities' voices weren't necessarily being counted?
I think it's in part because our culture, liberal democratic culture, if you want to call it that, understands children to be more like property than human beings. I think that's a sad fact, but it's pervasive. It's a part of our worldview. I think that this there are groups of children and youth who are even more silenced and more harmed by that silence. And yeah, children and youth with disabilities are part of that group that is even more marginalized from their rights than other children. And in part, it's because I think it's almost easier for people who don't live with a disability to commodify, objectify, render less than human people who have disabilities. I may be sounding harsh, it triggers some people, but I think that's the truth. And unless we face the truth, I don't know how we can create change. Because obviously it's an awful truth. It's an awful truth.
So would your advocacy efforts provide a voice for those affected, including children and youth with disabilities?
Well, I would say, you know, my sense, my understanding is we did not provide anybody with a voice. Children and youth with disabilities, whether they spoke or not, whatever, they had a voice. They have a voice. So we don't give somebody a voice. I think what we would have done, what we did do, what I continue to do, is try to create the conditions in which the voices say people with disabilities, young people, children with disabilities, both can be exercised and can be heard, and to be heard, not just I hear you, but be listened to, be understood. And that was a struggle. So we created those opportunities, those platforms, those spaces, if you will, where people could exercise their voice, use their voice, find their voice, the one they had, not the one anybody gave them, and where decision makers in their lives would be forced to listen. I mean, listen equal, try to understand, not just sit at a table and say, yeah, okay, I heard you, and then go about their life. I remember this saying that it's true. It's true for all people, but in this case, people with disabilities. We wanted people, we couldn't force decision makers to make a decision that young people wanted, but we could create a situation where they could do what they want. Decision makers could do what they want. Like, they could ignore it, they could write a report, they could make a program, they could change things, they could do what they want, but they could not live their lives ever again as if they never heard those voices. They couldn't. And I wanted and believe, and even to this day, I want young people who are participating in that kind of work. I want the people, young people who might hear my voice right now, I want them to know that when they speak up, they change the world. They change their world because they will be different when they name it, and they will change the world because when they speak up and they use their lived experience as wisdom, they don't bleed on the carpet for anybody, but they use their lived experience as wisdom. They have changed the world because people who have heard it cannot deny it, and they have to live their lives as if they have heard it. So. And it's so crucial, and that's called influence. And I would tell you that young people with disabilities and young people marginalized from their rights if they can find a space where they can use their voice, they have influence. They make change. They might not see it, might not result in some new program or something, but they have influence. And it's crucial these days that they speak up. I think so. And find allies to walk with them, support them to find their voice and use it. And protect them, really, because it can be dangerous using your voice. And I think that's really important to understand, too, and exhausting.
So, in your advocacy efforts, was there any success moment that you achieved that stands out for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, there was, I mean, I can think of lots, certainly tons individually, whether it was getting the support they need, these courageous young people who would fight for themselves, and things that they needed in their lives, and I watched them be successful in obtaining them, or fight for others. Like, that's always an amazing thing that I noticed about young people who are really in these battles, fighting barriers, that they are not always just fighting for themselves, but fighting for others, too. So I think there's tons, too many young people, individual young people, to tell you those stories. But the collective group, you know, the 100 or so young people with a range of what I call, and they hated this, what the government called special needs in quotation marks. 100 came together and put together a report that spoke in one voice. So it was not just young people, autistic young people, or it was not just young people with a physical disability, or young people facing mental health challenges. It was all of them together, and we were told it's not possible. And it was the adults who told us it was not possible, not the young. They said you can't, because they will fight with each other over whose disability was more difficult. And that was the adults. It wasn't the young people. When we brought them together, you know what? They understood each other. And they were able to say something together, and they called the report, "We Have Something to Say." It was the first of its kind, certainly in Ontario, probably in Canada, of a report written directly by, if I can say it, and I know this is not true all the time, but it was a pan-disability report of children and youth, as young as 12, as old into their 20s. That's another thing people said couldn't be done. The 12-year-olds and the 26-year-olds wouldn't be able to understand each other. Well, guess what? They did. And they wrote a report, and they tabled it, and they used that report to say, and that one of their key pieces to the bureaucracy across government was that we want to be seen as more than our disability. We are people. We're not even children. We're not even youth. We are human beings and people, and we want to be seen as that. When I say influence, that group had tremendous influence on the minister. Tremendous. It may have not changed the policy, because they didn't have time, because that group was closed down when their office was closed down by the Ford government. But that group influenced the way bureaucrats thought about their work. And boy, if they were permitted, supported, if there was a space where they could have stayed together, they would have been a force. And so I see it. I saw the influence that they had. And I am very proud of what they did. Not of what we did, meaning me as an office, but what they did. And to walk alongside them during that journey, I encourage anybody to listen to this. You can go to the Ontario Child Advocate Archives, because even though our office was closed, before we closed, we preserved it online, the reports that young people did. Go to ocaarchives.com, look for the report, "We Have Something to Say," read the report. It's a legacy of those young people, and frankly, they travel in the bright light of their full potential, and I know my staff would say they were fortunate to walk alongside them as they traveled, and the bright light of their full potential shone on us. The only reason you're interviewing me today is because of what those young people did.
Mike, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, Kevin.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Red Cross continues to work around the clock to respond to humanitarian need in Ukraine and surrounding countries. Canadians wishing to help are encouraged to donate to the Ukraine Humanitarian Crisis Appeal. Financial donations can be made online at redcross.ca, by calling 1-800-418-1111, or by texting Ukraine to 20222 to donate $10. More information at redcross.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from disabilities advocate Erwin Ellman, and Sakina Rahim gave us an update on Smile Canada. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Chandra Clark from VHLA. So, can you tell me a little bit about VHLA?
Sure. So, VHLA is a nonprofit organization. We focus on providing support, education, awareness, and advocacy for patients who have been impacted by the rare disease von Hippel-Lindau.
Can you tell me a little bit about the condition VHL itself?
Sure. So VHL disease is a genetic disorder. It leads to a lifetime of uninhibited and unpredictable tumor growth. The tumors can be malignant or benign, and the tumors can develop in up to 10 different organs. There's currently no cure, and there are minimal treatment options available besides surgery.
So, what types of supports does the association provide to the patient community?
So, we provide everything from patient support groups. So, we do monthly support calls. One of the most important resources that we provide is connecting VHL patients to clinical care centers. And so what that means is that if a patient was newly diagnosed, first of all, we would encourage them to contact the VHL Alliance, and then we would connect them with a clinical care center in their area, hopefully. And clinical care centers provide that specialized support that VHL patients need from physicians who are experts and knowledgeable in providing care to a VHL patient. We also conduct an annual family meeting in different parts of the United States. So we do that in partnership with one of our clinical care centers. And the purpose of those family meetings are to bring together VHL patients and caregivers and families to help them experience community and have a heightened level of support. And then we do a biannual symposium, and we do that in partnership with our clinical care center affiliates that are global. And we apply the same concept where we invite patients to attend, but we also have researchers present that are providing a presentation about updates and trends in VHL research.
So, how do you go about reaching out to the VHL community to let them know about your work?
So we do all that we can to reach out to the VHL community. So, of course, social media is probably the most popular platform that we use. So everything from Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. We also take every opportunity that we have, like today, to share information about our organization. We do utilize our partnerships with our clinical care centers and also other hospitals and community organizations to share information about the VHL Alliance. And then we also rely a lot on our current patient community to spread the word, because our goal is to support every person that has been impacted by VHL.
So when you say it's a rare condition, do you know offhand about how many people are affected?
So we use the statistics that 1 in 36,000 Americans are affected, and so that would equate to about 200,000 people across the globe.
So are there any myths or misperceptions about VHL that you encounter in your work?
That's really a hard question for me to answer, because I think that you have different people that have different experiences, which is why we really just encourage someone who has VHL to reach out to us so that we can connect them with an expert physician. I think that the number one misconception probably is that it only affects certain age groups, and BHL can impact anyone from a newborn to someone who is 60 years of age.
So, in your time with the Alliance, has there been any success moment that stands out for you, where you were able to provide direction and support to someone who needed it?
So the most significant success, I would say, during my time at the Alliance has been the FDA approval of the therapeutic drug belzutifan, which is also known as Welireg, and that is the first FDA, again, approved drug for BHL patients, and that has been a milestone for our organization, and that has really inspired a sense of hope for BHL patients and the impact that it will have on treatment and actually how it is affecting the tumors that BHL patients have in their bodies.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the need for advocacy and awareness of this condition, what would you say?
I would say that it's urgent. I think through my time at the Alliance, I am not only an advocate for BHL patients, I am an advocate for every rare disease patient, because I truly believe that everyone should have the opportunity to thrive and have the highest quality of life. I would say that it's really important, if you are a BHL patient, to one, seek the resources and support that is available to you, and also do not be afraid to share your story, because the hope is that not only that your life will be changed and that you will be able to thrive, but that you can also encourage other members of the BHL community to do the same.
So, what are the next steps for the Alliance?
Again, a hard question to answer. I think number one is remaining true to our mission and our vision. In the next few weeks, we will be sharing information from our updated strategic framework. So that will come out in our April newsletter. And we're really excited to talk about our refreshed vision and mission as we look to the future of the work of the BHL Alliance. In 2023, we will be moving into our 30th year. So it will be our 30th anniversary. So we're looking forward to really just doing kind of a walkthrough history of what we've accomplished in the past, our present, how phenomenal it is, and the excitement as we look to advance into the future. I would say another priority for us is just making sure that as an organization, we are supporting every BHL patient in the focus of diversity, equity, and inclusion at every level, because we want every BHL patient to feel a sense of community. We do not want anyone to feel isolated and alone.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
You know, my friends, I just love Irwin's story of people with disabilities coming together, uniting their voices. Too many times in the disability community, we can see the big name things being prioritized over the lesser known conditions. But it's only by working together in common cause that we can hope to make things better for all. Truth is, if disability affects one person, it affects their community. No matter what it is, no matter how pronounced or how well known the condition may be, fact is, that person has a right to achieve their best. And in coming together, in common cause, making their voices count, making them heard, opens the door for all those of us who might need just a little step forward into a better future. And that is something we should all be working towards. We're stronger as a community, my friends. It's not about one prioritized over another. Is about making things better for the entire community. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.